Welcome to the Dork Forest. Jackie and her pals will never bore us. Shameless confessions
about our obsessions
will make us laugh and smile. So let's explore the Dork Forest and dork out for a while.
Hi, Rangers of the Dork Forest. It's me, Jackie Cation, and you are listening to the Dork Forest. You can go to the websites, JackieCation.com and DorkForest.com. JackieCation.com has DorkForest.com. It has the audio links. It has the video links to my YouTube. It has all of my dates for stand-up comedy. It has all the merch. It's got Dork Forest merch and stand-up merch and all of my CDs and DVDs if you have those devices. Other things you can do, Bandcamp. There's a Bandcamp with the very old episodes. Some of them are free. And then there's a storytelling album that you can get on my Bandcamp. And I'm on Pandora and Spotify. It is 2025, and feel free to start donating to the Dork Forest. Yeah, cost me about 10 grand a year to put this up. If everybody donated $100 every year, if everybody just handed me $100 every time they saw me, or PayPal, Venmo, then I would have, I think, about 10 grand. I don't know, but I would have enough money to run this and probably buy myself lunch. And I'm a big fan of doing the show. I'll do it anyway. But if you have $100, send me $100. If you have $2, send me $2. You can do it monthly on PayPal. There's buttons all over my website. And my Venmo is just my name. No hyphen, Jackie Cation. I'm wearing a red shirt. Let's get into the show. Hello and welcome to the Dork Forest. I'm in the dark. My guest is in the light of science. I am on the road in a hotel. Welcome to the program, Alex Matthews. How are you?
I'm doing great. It's a fabulous weekend morning.
Yes, we just ran into each other on a couple of different comedy shows, and we ended up talking, and you said that you have a thing that you're studying in college, but you also... you were ready to dork out about it in the moment. And I was like, let's get it under control. Let's actually record it. That'll be perfect.
Absolutely.
So it's food science. Wait, actually, let me just do, your Instagram is at @ZE_Matthews. It'll be in the notes, of course, but Alexander Matthews, and it's, @ZE_Matthews. There we go. Now we all know. And now, here's what I know about food science. That Michael Pollan book and
yes.
Documentary. That's all I know. I read them and then I watched the thing and I was told that the apple was very important. And so all I know, and then I know that it was used, the power of food science was used briefly for evil to create margarine. But that's all.
I can talk a bit about that too. I have some knowledge about that.
Okay, so what brought you to food science? First of all, what
absolutely
did you, yeah.
So first of all, a bit about my background. I am in my final year at Cal Poly Pomona, which is a polytechnic university here in Southern California, and I am an active student leader in the food science and technology program at Cal Poly Pomona.
Okay.
So we'll get into a bit of more what food science is later on, but just background, I'm in my last year of college. Please, and just tell you a disclaimer, on nutrition knowledge, especially, that can be something that would be controversial, people have different opinions about. I am an undergraduate student. I know a lot, but it's a shallow knowledge. It's not a very deep
right.
knowledge.
Right.
I am taking nutrition
wide...
right now.
Yes. Okay.
So not take my word, even though this is a podcast, I doubt anyone will take my words as fact and verbatim. Do a bit of your own research. Talk to actual nutritionists and dietitians. If you have any serious nutritional questions,
ooh,
I'm here for fun trivia,
yes.
Not for, hey, is this going to kill me if I eat it, if I have salad,
right, right.
Anything along those lines. Anywho, that out of the way, I loved cooking as a kid. I love cooking and I've loved it for many years.
Okay.
I was actually a book
That's
kid, like
it.
You.
Okay.
I approached cooking. I got into cooking in the most roundabout way of literally having my nose in a book in the library, going to the cookbook section on an unimaginable whim at some point, and getting engrossed in one cookbook, the San Francisco Firehouse cookbook.
Oh, so it was fire trucks and cookbooks.
Not and even fire trucks, just browsing the library and looking at a book that had good, that had looked good and had good illustrations. Okay. It turns out San Francisco fire departments, in general, fire departments have to be good because you have a bunch of dudes living in one place for a long time. They have to, they're going to be working real hard, but they also are, have long, a lot of time where they're just waiting for something to happen.
Right.
So they oftentimes have actually really good cooking. They eat very well, especially in San Francisco, which is a foodie city. But they also have to be flexible because if they're called out in the middle of cooking, they, who knows when they're getting back.
Right.
So imagine a lot of long braises, but very flexible, easy recipes that a lot of range of
pots and
not or just ribs in the oven or really in the best Caesar salads. Something can be done really quickly or over a long period of time or be really flexible and in between.
Okay.
Incredible food, and it's an incredible cookbook. It really got me into cooking. I borrowed that book from the library for about a year and a year and a half in a row before my parents just ended up getting me the book.
Right. You were just like, I'm going to also keep this book. Yeah.
From my book nerd, bookish start, I got into cooking and found myself slowly but surely becoming a home cook. My parents were generous with, thank God we have a great kitchen. My kitchen had been renovated when I was fairly young, so it's very good kitchen to work with.
Big enough kitchen to sort of spread out. And,
and I was lucky enough to have relatively, I'll say open covers, but a lot of flexibility with in the understanding with getting weird ingredients if I needed to, because it was my passion. However, relatively early on, I knew that I wasn't going to be a professional chef or work in the restaurant industry. And there's two things that brought me to that conclusion. One, I'm a good cook. I'm not a good chef. I wouldn't say I'm the best chef because I still don't have the best time management skills. I'm passable. Okay. I do good work, but I don't do things quickly for the most part.
Do you think that that's a learned skill? Like if you had gone to culinary school, you might have learned that
it is
the multitasking. And yep.
First of all, as a I have relatively relatively poor hand strength and somewhat bad hand eye coordination on that neurodiversity spectrum, and thus tags on it. But I could have gotten over that. The other thing is, after reading again another book, Anthony Bourdain's Kitchen Confidential. Just seeing the even though that's an account of a restaurant industry largely gone in terms of the drugs aspect of it and other aspects, it's very much still an industry where you are expected to work hard for a very long amount of time. You're on your feet. You are, even if it's your passion, you are putting your back into it. You're putting your life into it for a lot of your time, especially if you want to be, well, an acclaimed chef or someone people
like very successful at it.
Exactly. Yeah.
Have you ever worked in a restaurant?
I have. Have you ever been to Legoland California Resort?
No, but I've always kind of wanted to go, even though Legos are not my downfall.
If you have any younger nieces, nephews, anything of that sort, it's
or
a
just
really great
adult
theme park.
Friends who love Legos, actually.
Oh,
is
yeah,
what I
that
do
too.
Have. Yes.
I didn't work on a full on hot food restaurant. I was a soft serve machine. I served soft serve ice cream.
Guy. Okay.
Not just soft serve ice cream. It was a very complex system that instead of having different flavors, one base vanilla. But the flavors were in syrups that are swirled throughout it. If you ever look up Merlin ice cream cones or a Merlin ice cream at Legoland, it's kind of trippy looking.
Yeah, but it sounds trippy looking if there's 1,000 different syrups that you can.
It's a big old machine. It's only about eight. There's nine syrups, but six syrups. But the machine, you have to learn how to, you know, literally deconstruct it and reconstruct it and clean it out every night and reconstruct it every morning. It has about in just the parts you're taking off of it, the parts that you are handling, not like the refrigerant and all the cooling, you are handling about 43 moving parts. And so it is a pretty complex machine because it's supposed to look good and taste good, but it's much more complex product than just.
And you had to break it down every night and clean it. And then good to know. I will have soft serve ice cream when I go to Legoland because of this story. because I was a dishwasher in high school, mm-hmm. and that was filthy and thankless. And it wasn't mm-hmm. thankless. People were very thankful.
Yes.
And then I worked at a hot dog stand, and it was like a clam shack, hot dog stand, fryer situation, mm-hmm. 3 summers in a row in Massachusetts mm-hmm. on the Cape. And mm-hmm. then, that's all the restaurant. I mean, it's a very hard work to work at a restaurant.
Absolutely.
But
I had an amazing experience at Legoland. The one customer service, true customer service I've ever had was actually incredible, and I was not expecting to like it. But I know exactly why, because I saw most other jobs in the park had the customer service stories and issues we know.
Okay.
I had only one Karen experience, which we can talk about maybe later. But the reason I didn't have Karen experiences, I didn't have people screaming at me, even though this was working at a theme park in the middle of COVID, is simply this. Remember the last time you were at a theme park, especially with young kids?
Yeah.
Think of when you were getting hot food, lunch or dinner. Everyone is hungry. Everyone is hangry. The parents are hungry. The kids are hungry. Yep. You've probably been out doing stuff and are, well, tired
you're
out
tired,
and lashing out at each
down,
other
you
and
eat
other
some
people.
Real food. Yep.
Think of what your mental state is like when you're waiting for your kid in the ice cream line compared to that.
That's
you're probably not angry at the world and the lines. You're probably just giving your kid a treat because they weren't screaming for 5 hours in a row.
Okay. It's a better
so
look at
people
it.
Are nice, and I actually enjoyed doing the, you know, how was your day? You know, customer service, tour guide, a bit of tour guide for my local area because I'm from Legoland, literally 5 minutes away from Legoland.
Okay.
What local beaches are good if I have long enough to talk to people, like there's no line, all that stuff. I enjoyed it, but if I was working in hot food, as I had to do very occasionally, I know I would have not enjoyed that nearly as much.
Right, a little grumpier. Fair enough. Okay.
Yes.
I am fascinated and psyched that you are breaking down the machine. Because that's not, I mean, it's food service. We had to empty the fry later, but mm-hmm. we didn't do it as often as we should have. Let's just say that. It was also a tourist destination. And so there were a lot of things being fried. So it could have been emptied every day or two, but I think it was every 3 days, sadly. Anyway.
Yeah. Before you get back into how I got to be a food scientist, that just reminded me, frying oil, especially in commercial deep fat fryers,
mm-hmm.
It is good to empty it. Depending on how much frying you do, yes, every two days, 3 days. However, especially in a small in home cooking and very smaller operations, reusing frying oil is actually, to an extent, for a bit good, and then it goes back, and then it's not as good again. When you're frying foods, you are applying a lot of heat to lipids, these fatty acids, and as you have a bunch of foods frying in them and little pieces of breading and carbs degrading and, you know, going to the bottom, that and the breaking down of the lipid chains in very small amounts actually reduces the boiling temperature of the oil. So it makes it more energy efficient to fry things in. And it does add a little bit of extra fried taste. So actually the biggest fast food restaurants, I believe they do incorporate, the energy savings into their cost operations of using fried oil. However, you do not want to use frying oil for, especially in the same deep fryer. You don't want cooking it too often because then you start getting burnt flavors. The fatty acids start breaking down even more, and it can start forming acrylamides. Which, if you're in the state of California and see those warning labels about this stuff has acrylamides, may cause cancer, that's very small amounts. Safe, but if you're eating fried food every day and all of these buildup of acrylamides, which is a relatively innocent thing, but it's produced from the breakdown of fatty acids under very high heat and over extended periods of time. If you eat them too much for too long, studies have shown increased risk of, I believe, colonic or intestinal cancer.
Okay.
So don't eat the chicken McNuggets for the breakfast, lunch, and dinner is what I'm saying.
Right. Just try to keep it together and try not to have fried fruits every day. Yes.
If you want to, if you deep fry something, you're like, I don't want to dump out all this frying oil after frying something in it once at home.
Yes.
Save it. It's going to be probably easier to cook with the next time you use it use it once or twice. It's not.
Can you? Would bad. You? Could you freeze it?
Not okay. No, freezing
oil.
Freezing doesn't really work with actually
everything.
Maybe with stuff that's more saturated, like butter. Butter you can freeze. I assume animal fats you can freeze. More unsaturated fats, think avocado, think olive, think canola.
Or, yeah.
They don't freeze as well because they're more liable to break down under heat shifts.
Oh, okay. Whereas so you can get a bit more like separate or split? Oh, yeah.
On the molecular level, yes. On the it basically leads to oxidation and rancidity, you know, like rancid butter. That if you keep your butter in the freezer, that's perfectly fine. It's saturated enough. It's saturated meaning it has more hydrogen. It doesn't have any double bonds on, you know, the molecular chain organic chemistry rise.
Okay.
Basically means it's more stable.
Okay.
Less stable stuff doesn't take well to big heat shifts and other
If you fry something with canola oil or whatever,
yeah,
and then you want to save that oil, you have to save it in the fridge. Don't save it in the...
Well, not even in the fridge. Just empty bottle and just funnel it in. It keeps
how
on.
How long will it last before it too grows
it
rancid?
It won't last as long as regular oil because it probably has a bit of fried bits, but probably like a good month or two in my experience.
All right. And know that Alexander has said double check. So yes. So
yes.
That is you know, that is probably right, but make sure you get at least one more source on that.
Yes.
And
I do have a list of recommended reading at the end of this too.
He's brought a syllabus. So the
perhaps
the okay, so you cook, but you don't want to, you end up not deciding not to go into professional restauranting, cooking and chefing and this type of thing, but you're still interested in food.
Exactly. I still love food. I want to work with food. I also want to not be working on my feet all day, every day. I want to have something that engages me mentally more than physically, perhaps.
Okay.
And I like science. I like history and culture. I wanted to find something that combined as many of those things as possible. And
history
I was
and
so
culture.
Happy to find a bit, not so much of that, but that's my own hobbies within food science.
Okay.
Food science usually doesn't go into the food culture, but there are some, some people who study more food studies is actually a thing. Usually subsets of either anthropology, sociology, it kind of is more a small field, but of kind of interdisciplinary food studies. I believe UCLA has a program in it. A few universities in the United States and Europe have it.
Wow. Well, I like the idea of it. Have you taken any of those classes, sort of food studies?
So my university doesn't really, I've taken things that are like food and culture, which at my university is more along the lines of nutrition. Which because we have a big dietetics program, dietitians should know the dietary habits and just general. They should know as much about the cultures that they're serving as possible. Because if you are telling, regardless of what culture your who your clients are,
the
who
group
your patients
of people
are,
yeah,
what their dietary habits, what they eat or don't eat matters. If you're telling them you should eat apples and bananas to get this vitamin, and that's just not something that they regularly consume in their diet, and they have some other things that are more culturally appropriate that they regularly consume, especially in immigrant communities, which are very common in, of course, the United States.
Yep.
They need both medical practitioners and especially dietitians who know how they operate, how their diets work and what people normally eat.
That makes sense. Just to have to know the specifics to the people that you're trying to actually serve that community. So
exactly. So I took a food and culture course because of that program.
Okay. And so what's the science on what you're doing? Like what kind of science
Absolutely.
Do you have to know?
So food science is usually at my university, it's within the same department. It's nutrition and food science. Kind of two sides of the same coin, but we do different things. We don't do a huge amount of collaboration other than extracurricular stuff.
Okay.
So food science is the applied science of food. So it seems simple enough, but we are looking at food at the microscopic, macroscopic levels, from the molecule, from how different molecules of that make up our food work and interact with each other, to how do I make an entire food processing line that can heat, that can pasteurize hundreds of gallons of milk every second, everything on that scale.
Okay.
So food science, again, it's you're studying the physical, biological, and chemical makeup of food, how and everything that happens to it. So before you get into the actual food science courses at most universities, including my own, you have to get to know science.
Yeah, like chemistry.
A lot of chemistry.
A lot of chemistry. And
mm-hmm. Organic chemistry, general chemistry, now biochemistry
right.
at my university, though I believe my class was one of the last, in terms of like the year I entered, was one of the last where you didn't have to take biochemistry. Now it is mandatory for any incoming majors. Also biology, especially basic biology and especially microbiology.
Okay. And microbiology, is that like atoms and, I mean,
oh,
how?
No. That is bacteria and fungi.
Okay. Thank you.
And it's anything living that is either too small to see with the naked eye or too small to easily deal with your hands. So in most cases, that is leading us into food processing and food safety.
Okay.
Those are prerequisites for.
So is the chemistry and biology that you're studying, is it mostly plants or is it plants and animals?
Everything. Anything that becomes food, we end up having to study. We have to take the, you know, basic biologies and chemistries, even some physics and engineering.
Okay.
In statistics and all that. We have to take all these courses that everyone at a lot of STEM majors is science majors at universities have to take. But then in our up division courses, where we start doing more straight up food science courses, we are applying these principles, everything we've learned previously, to actual foods. And we usually don't think of it, we usually don't separate like class on plants, class on animals. In most cases, we are doing food chemistry, which looks at the building blocks of food at the chemical level. So carbohydrates, proteins, lipids, water, of course, is very important because it's most of food. Most of us is water.
Right. It's true. Are they mostly teaching these classes for you to enter into the food industry as a chemist or biology, or what is that?
That is correct. So most people in food science do end up in the food industry. So in the food industry, what food scientists will do, they can do many things, but what most of them end up doing is product development or quality assurance are the two biggest job titles, I would say.
I have a friend who is a food scientist and has been for 40 years. He went to Purdue, graduated in the late 80s. He went to China to teach them how to make instant coffee.
Yes.
And so he worked for General Mills or General Foods or he always referred to it as the General. And it was some sort of large
General Mills.
Okay, some large corporation. And in 1989, he had, you know, those Starbucks iced coffees?
Mm-hmm.
He brought home a 4-pack of essentially iced coffee in a jar that had been sweetened. But it was 1989.
So Starbucks hadn't really hit the scene.
Yeah, Starbucks didn't even exist. And so I tried it with his wife, one of my best friends, and I said, what the hell? This is disgusting. Why would you drink cold coffee? And here we are, 40 years later, 35 years later.
The explosion of coffee culture in the United States, probably one of the biggest massive shifts in our food culture within the last 40 years. It's really been massive. previously, almost everywhere in the United States, coffee is coffee. It's just you brew the beans. And now espresso variation of espresso culture that places like Pete's and Starbucks have spread across the United States and the world is what people think of as coffee. I mean, I ask most of my peers in at university of my age, when they think of coffee, I don't drink coffee myself, but when my peers think of coffee, they're thinking espresso drinks, they're thinking cappuccinos. Very few people just drink up straight coffee in most cases.
That's amazing. That is, yeah, my husband Andy does not drink mm-hmm. coffee, and mm-hmm. He's actually not even interested in it. So are there other foods that have changed sort of, because it sort of changed the course of how people hang out and where people go. Yeah. And it did more than just, you know, now we're drinking a lot of coffee, which makes mm-hmm. us very aggressive. I was told by my hippie friends that possibly too much coffee can make you a little aggro. So
I'd like to do a study on driving behavior in drive-through Starbucks now with that in my mind.
Okay.
That's fascinating to think about.
Yeah. So I have asked sort of the main questions I wanted to ask. What do you love about it? What are some of the weird things?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So as a person who has a lot of love for culture and history and its application in food science, that means I like trivia. I like learning weird little nuggets of information that can be really interesting jumping off points for strange conversations. I apply this in a competition called the College Bowl, which is the most intimidating, like, sporty name for what is essentially a high-stakes competitive team food science trivia.
Okay.
It is run by the Institute of Food Technologists, which is the professional association for food scientists in the United States and much of the world. It is run by the Institute of Food Technologists Student Association. And almost every university that has food science in the United States has a student chapter of IFTSA.
Okay.
Including my own. I'm very active in it. That's not the point. IFTSA runs several competitions. There's product development competitions where literally people are developing entirely new products, just like you would in industry, and competing with both their business plans and the actual quality and safety and taste of their product with
science
judges
fair.
From across the industry.
Yeah. Okay.
Imagine a science fair, but you've worked on it for like nine months, and you've actually done sensory studies, and you're literally making a food product. You're making packaging.
You're making food.
You're making processing diagrams. You're doing everything that industry would, because this is probably what you're going to do in the future.
Right.
So there's product development competitions, there's research competitions, but the most fun one, at least in my opinion, is College Bowl. We have two teams of four. University has a team. You have two teams of four people going up against each other at the time. They're at tables. They have buzzers. It's literally like a game show.
Right.
They're asked questions from any area of food science, whether it's the weirdest trivia question or the most high, most technical engineering question.
Okay.
And it's a race to buzz in, get points, answer correctly, or lose points if you answer incorrectly.
Right.
There's even more in-depth bonus questions where the entire team gets to collaborate, but they're usually much harder.
Okay.
So I've done this for about 4 years. It is an incredibly fun extracurricular.
Okay. And do they do it normal? Do they do it regularly? Like, is it weekly
it is
or
annual
monthly
event?
Or? Oh, annual.
It is. So
and how many
there are the regionals, which are coming up in late March.
Okay.
That if the winner of the regionals, because each university is in its own region.
Okay.
Of IFTSA. The team that wins regionals, it's double elimination, you know, bracketed. Team that wins regionals goes on to nationals, which is held at the big IFT first convention in Chicago, Illinois, which I've had the pleasure of going to twice. And it's amazing.
Right.
And
Go ahead.
Nope.
Are there good, like, all I was going to say is, like, what were your favorite questions? I mean, what are they?
That's what I was getting into. I've made many rounds of practice rounds because literally our teams practice the entire school year for this event.
Okay.
Because it's both, you know, it's fun, but also teaches us a lot about even stuff that we haven't taken, information from classes we haven't taken yet. And it helps us with our confidence. You know, you're literally buzzing in to say something that you're sure about. And that's really intimidating for a lot of people when you're up on stage in front of dozens or hundreds of people.
Right, right.
And you don't want to be wrong.
Yeah. You want to be fast. You want to be accurate. And it can be intimidating. But,
so you have to
And then
stuff.
All weird topics of things that may not have been stuff you studied.
Yeah. So, yeah, I've taken a few questions, both stuff that I – from questions I've seen and rounds that I've made as practice.
Okay.
So I'm going to ask you a couple of them, and if you know the story, great. But if you have a – but if you don't, then we can
talk
about it.
As long as it isn't a band, I've got a good chance. Let's do it.
We're good. What kitchen appliance inspired Nike's first shoe? Think about the sole of the shoe
pan?
As well. Closer than you'd think. Waffle iron.
Oh, right, because of the grip.
Yep. I forget his name, but the inventor of Nike, the founder of Nike,
right,
literally was trying to design sports shoes back in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And he saw his wife pouring waffle batter into a waffle iron, and mm-hmm. he had a eureka moment and borrowed the waffle iron for a few days with his wife's permission and poured the rubber that they make suit holes into it and use that patterning to create the first gridiron, I think it was called, Nike shoe.
Okay.
And of course, it's gone much more advanced after that, but waffles are the original inspiration for Nike.
And how often do you eat waffles? She was probably like, sure, but if you're going to take it to work, do me a favor, really clean it before you bring back your weird plastic shoe, you know, whatever mold you're making. That's awesome.
It's hilarious. If you ever take a chance, look up the Nike first shoe waffle. It literally they use almost identically the sole, the underside of the shoe. It's like just a waffle. It's the same shape. I think it may have made the size a bit smaller, but it's hilarious to look at.
That's awesome. I love that. That's, I mean, because where else would you get ideas to make anything? You would get the idea from just looking around going, all right, well, that's going to be whatever that is, you know? So that's hilarious. What else you got? Yeah.
Well, this is a bit of a more conventional question. Do you know the difference between jelly and jam? Not many people do. Because what do you think about this?
I have heard it told to me, but I do not know offhand. Please elaborate.
So jams are made with the whole fruit. Try to smash it, you get it down to a nice consistency, and you mix sugar in, cook it with sugar. It's a nice, you know, essentially
it's
a sugary.
It's like the whole raspberry.
Yes. Yeah, so if you're doing a jam, you have the seeds, you probably have extra fiber from the skins and other parts of the fruit. Jelly, you're just using the juice. If you have grape jelly, you have grape juice that you mix with sugar and some sort of gelling agent, perhaps. And you cook it down and you put it in a jar.
Why is anyone eating jelly? This is not, don't you want the whole fruit? I would think that it would be healthier to have the whole fruit.
I mean, jelly does have a kind of cleaner consistency if you really like that. I'm not huge consumers of either, but.
Right, right. I mean, I the amount of jelly and jam I eat, it's twice, three times a year, maybe. And we have all the different kinds. But. What you're saying is that, and it's probably why I've never seen a strawberry rhubarb jelly.
Yes.
Because you can't really juice a rhubarb. And,
or take all the seeds out off a strawberry at that point.
Right. 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 Oh my God. All right. Well, there's a fun fact.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And again, if you have any, like, if even like doing explanation comes up that you you want to inquire about, I'm happy to answer questions. If anyone, even listening, has a burning food science questions, maybe email it in or
go to Z_Mathios and ping him on the Instagram, and he would no doubt want to talk to you about whatever your question might be.
If I don't know it, I know someone who does.
Yeah, you do. It's what would be your sort of dream industry to work in food wise?
So this is gonna get interesting because my dream job is, because I have hope, to work in regulatory with the FDA or the USDA.
Oh yeah, there is trouble.
We're recording this in February of 2025, and there's happening to federal bureaucracy.
33 days into a real shit show. So what is that job? Has that job been traditionally working at the FDA or the?
There are many different roles that people with the FDA do.
Okay.
In the food operations, there's many roles under that, but what a lot of people do and what I would want to start with would be being a inspector. Food processing facility in the United States that is of a certain size is registered with the FDA.
Okay.
Every single one. Because if you have an outbreak of some foodborne illness,
right,
and it has to be traced back to somewhere to address it.
Okay. Because then you can find sort of ground zero and then clean it up from that area just see where the closest place you could sort of stop it so that it doesn't just keep spreading and you don't have to stop it too far away when there might be healthy food. Like there's probably healthy food 60 miles from there and you could stop the spread at like 30 or 20 or something. Yeah. Okay.
So what you have is you have people, every food, the vast majority of food processing facilities in the United States have to be inspected it depends on the facility, but every so often, could be multiple times a year, could be every 3 years. Usually the less compliant, the more past history there's been of issues at a food processing facility, the more it's inspected by the FDA.
Okay.
But you have basically inspectors going on a circuit in a given region from facility to facility to facility and essentially auditing, but not with money, but with everything else. Is there any signs of, there's a leak in the ceiling in the production, in the production room. How is that being addressed? Is it near any, is it from refrigeration? Are we able to, perhaps they're going to take samples and test for microbiological data, especially if there's instances of bacterial pathogens like Listeria
or
Shigella coming from that facility in the past at any point.
Okay.
These are people who regularly visit every facility and, if necessary, take action and ramping up to, I believe, in the early 2010s, you remember the peanut butter? When all the peanut butter manufacturer got shut down?
Much like jelly and jam, two or three times a year with the peanut butter. So did they have to shut down a lot of peanut butter?
This probably is one of the most horrific cases of abuse of food safety in recent history.
Really?
Usually, if there's something wrong going in the facility, it's out of maybe, it could be out of ignorance or apathy or just not knowing the proper procedure, but it's very rarely out of explicit criminal negligence, for a prolonged period of time.
Yeah.
Then there was one of the worst examples of that, which is rare, but actually happened.
Yeah.
Is the Peanut Corporation of America. It was run by a man named Stephen Parnell.
They sound so respectable. The Peanut Corporation of America.
They were a respectable company. I believe they were a family-run business. And when there was the next generation took over, they as a peanut processor in, I believe, Georgia and Virginia, in the American Southeast, they started lowering their standards.
Okay.
And
what was the name of the guy?
Their facilities started getting...
I introduced.
This man, so the man who was the man who had the most strict sentencing from the incident is named Stephen Parnell.
Okay.
And if you mention him in food circles, especially food safety circles, you will get you'll get your pin drop. Everyone knows this story, and this is like one of the most horrific stories of negligence in modern food science.
Okay.
There was repeated salmonella outbreaks because of his peanut butter. Huh. And he used every method he could to throw off the FDA and delay proceedings. His facilities were absurdly like turn of the century.
Like 1900. Like, turn of the century.
1900, the reason we have any food loss level of dirty rat droppings, bugs, leaks, etc. It's like a whole nother level. And he probably, he received one of the longest sentences for criminal negligence for foodborne illness, for being responsible for foodborne illness, I think ever. I think it was 30 years because of people died because of his actions.
Yeah.
There is a law, I forget the exact one, but if a food company, especially if there is actual harm and especially death because of a foodborne illness outbreak, even if it's criminal negligence, which is usually not, you know, something that gets a very high sentence, if people die because people didn't take food safety in cleanliness seriously, the executives of that company can, and there's a process to make them be charged for very high counts of criminal negligence because they are responsible for.
Are they ever charged with murder? Like some sort of manslaughter or?
I believe it's like that level. Basically, because they didn't. They do that exact same year of like the amount of the sentence of manslaughter. But for criminal negligence, because even if they didn't, even if they, you know, didn't directly, you know, intend it, they allowed food that they knew was utterly unsafe for human consumption to enter the marketplace to do whoever ate it. And it's not obviously not the employee's fault. It's who, you know, they're oftentimes, you know, working relatively low paid workers. So I mean, it likely isn't even the lower level quality assurance people's fault. It's really the executives, which could include the manager of quality, people who are supposed to be keeping this activity in check. And of course, the presidents of the company who, in this case, were extremely oblique and belligerent in allowing this to happen.
Like literally just for the point of profits. They're like, we're not going to fix this.
This is a case that is almost... This is not a thing that happens in most situations. Whenever you hear about food recall, even if there's a bit of mishandling of communication, what Peanut Corporation of America did is pretty much unheard of in terms of the sheer evilness, basically, in the food industry.
Just the scale and
the scale and just how outright they were in allowing this to happen in preventing inspection and not changing things.
Right. Did it feel like, did they at some point feel like it was purposeful? They're like, who cares who dies when they eat peanut butter?
Yeah, it was very I believe internal communications from executives and the company that was seized by, you know, the FDA and other agencies were indicating that. The FDA, fun fact, does have an Office of Criminal Investigations. There are FDA inspectors who are officers of the law. They carry firearms. You'll never see them, though. They're very small, and they're mostly working with, you know, drug.
Illegal drugs. Okay.
More like illegal, like off-brand pharmaceuticals that are actually causing harm. But in the case of the Peanut Corporation of America, it was those people at U.S. sheriffs. They got cracked down on hard in the end.
Wow. They got the attention of the guys with the guns.
That's hard to do.
That is hard to do in the food industry. Did you do any, are you also with your degree studying sort of drug The food science, does it involve drug science? No? Okay.
I could, I probably, with my background, could do fairly well in trying to enter like the cosmetics industry or maybe in pharmaceutical, people okay. do. But mostly going in there from a quality assurance perspective okay. of we know how the, even if we don't know the product itself or how product itself, mm-hmm. we still know a lot of chemistry. Mm-hmm. We have a very good amount of knowledge on how to keep, how to process things, how to, you know, have certain levels of standards for how clean something is or how pure something is or how various attributes of the food, or in this case, drug. It's just with drugs, you have to be a lot more careful. And okay. All the regulations are a lot stricter in terms of if this is a pill like of this medication, it yeah. has to be exactly this amount of medication.
Okay, that this, makes that know, makes sense. Dosage. And that kind of thing.
You can be a bit more loose with food.
Right.
Not by much, but a little.
Yeah, I can't imagine it's a lot, but it does make sense yeah. that it's a little more, there's a lot more minutia when you're dealing yeah. with milligrams of oxycodone or whatever it's called. Mm. yeah. What's another fun fact about food science? What do you got?
Absolutely. Long story short, I do hope to be a work in government someday. I have a very strong sense of civics. I want to work I want to do work that affects that is able to contribute positively to people across a region, possibly even across the country. Yeah. That is not going to happen anytime soon, and I'm okay with that. And I'm going to do. I know I've worked in industry before, and I enjoyed it, so I'm gonna do what I can to prepare myself for a better time.
Yeah, yeah. You'll yes. get experience in the private sector, and then
absolutely.
And then when we have a government again, you can possibly get a job in the government. So
I hope to be part of a glorious restoration of the federal bureaucracy, as weird as that sounds.
Right. That is a glass half full attitude. It's yeah. going to be, here's what's happening, you guys. It's going to be a bloodbath, mm-hmm. and then there's going to be a glorious restoration. And that is what has happened in every government, in everything on the planet. And we thought we were past it, but mm-hmm. me and my undergraduate degree in political science can tell you that we're not past it. Anyway, yes. so
more fun food facts.
More food. Yes, please.
So this is another challenge for you. Can you order the following five foods in order of invention from oldest to newest?
Oh.
Potato chips.
Potato
sliced
chips.
Sliced bread.
Okay.
Potato chips, sliced bread, cheese whiz, spam, and cornflakes. I know a good bit about each food, but it's just a really thing because you don't think of these foods as being like old. Think of it, especially of certain times, but you just, when you think about it, you don't really know how old they are.
Well, now, I saw a documentary on PBS about spam.
Yes.
It was about Hormel and Oscar Mayer. Mm-hmm. And it was about processed meats. And it was fascinating, actually. And I know that the guy at Hormel actually invented the hourly wage. This is what I know about that guy. It was
interesting.
Did you know that? It was right during at the beginning of the Depression, of course. Mm-hmm. Hormel made fancy canned meats. That was their jam. They were whole meats. Anyway, mm-hmm. so but the seeds and all were put into cans, and they sold them to fancy people for an extraordinary mm-hmm. amount of money. And then mm-hmm. the Depression happened, and in rural Minnesota, he did not want to fire anybody. So he said, I'm not going to fire everybody. I'm going to make sure everybody works every week. So for a month or two, there was no structure. He just tried to do it. And so thousands of factory workers rioted. And they said, we have to know that we're making what we're making per week of anything. Mm-hmm. And he's like, excellent point. Please don't kill me. Here's an idea. How about everybody gets 8 hours a week
mm-hmm.
for sure? And so then you will make at least $16 a week or whatever. Mm-hmm. These numbers are approximations. I can't remember exactly. Mm-hmm. So he actually created the minimum wage.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And I guaranteed, and he was also the guy who created, I think it was company insurance.
Oh,
where he covered corporate insurance. So now that was in, and then he created spam in the late 30s, and then World yes. War II happened. This is the only one I know. A potato chip seems like it should have been created very early on. Cheese Whiz mm-hmm. seems to have some sort of launching vehicle. That feels more like the 50s. Corn Flakes.
Mm-hmm.
Is that Post? Who invented? I know I shouldn't ask for hints.
Kellogg's.
It was Kellogg? Okay. And
Post immediately
bread.
Had their own version, though.
You're talking mm-hmm. sliced bread in a package, not just the idea of slicing bread as opposed to
sliced bread
it apart?
That you buy and it's already sliced.
There we go.
In the
there
market.
We go. I'm going to go. It's going to be pretty arbitrary. I'm going to go potato chips, mm-hmm. Sliced bread, Spam, Corn Flakes, Cheese Whiz.
Close. Corn Flakes are off.
Corn Flakes are off? I knew it. As soon as I said it, I was like, should have put them earlier. Where were they?
All good. So potato chips is 1850, in the early, the 1830s approximately. The legend goes that they were invented in 1853, but there's recipes from the 30s. It's just they're popularized in the early, mid 19th century.
Okay.
They were actually originally only in upstate New York. They're like an upstate New York delicacy.
Okay.
It's like local, you know, food.
Where they're shaven potatoes.
Yeah.
They're frying
like, think,
them.
You know, like the Thousand Islands, like the resort communities where all the rich New Yorkers would go.
Right.
Catskills and all that. That's where potato chips would be like, oh, this is a fun local delicacy that it's just a New York thing.
Okay.
Then a guy from the South, a guy named Lay, goes up to New York, loves it, thinks, okay, it's a turn of the century. We know how to package things better, because otherwise, you know, if they're doing it on horse and wagon and stuff, it's just going to get crushed up in the bag.
Right. Then you just have all shake. Just all
yeah,
potato chips.
I'm going to bring these back down south, and I'm going to make a fortune making them. And
okay.
That's where we get Lay's from. So potato
that's
chips
amazing.
First. Then cornflakes.
Oh.
Cornflakes were the 1890s.
As a cereal?
Yes. It is flaked. It is cooked, flaked, puffed corn.
Okay.
It was invented at the Battle Creek Sanitarium, which is
Michigan.
Run by the Kelloggs. Correct. Where both Battle Creek is where Post and Kellogg started.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
I'm in Royal Oak, which is right outside
of
Detroit.
Yeah, you're not far. Long story short, the Seventh-day Adventists had a very... The Seventh-day Adventists had, which have, of course, very strict health, very strict, very strong views on health and diet. Exactly.
Yeah.
They had a community up in Battle Creek. They ran a sanitary, basically a hospital and health spa that became extremely popular under the leadership of the brothers Kellogg, John Harvey Kellogg and William Keith Kellogg.
Oh, I don't think I knew they were Seventh-day Adventists. Look at me.
They were very Seventh-day Adventists. They were.
Okay.
They had this health spa that everyone from Amelia Earhart, William Howard Taft, Henry Ford, Edison, all the great people, all like the cream of the crop of the early 20th century would go here.
Right.
To basically do cleansing. They'd cleanse themselves. They'd work out. They'd eat better. They'd try to feel better. And
right, then they'd go back
they had
and
many
drink scotch and smoke cigars
exactly.
and with a bunch of Knickerbockers. Anyway.
And fly a plane into the Pacific.
Right.
So they read this, they didn't eat meat. They eschewed, especially back then, eschewed spices and other such things. They wanted kind of bland, hearty, nutritious food. So the Kellogg's are... So the Kellogg's invent a... way to basically they're a way to puff wheat and make cornflakes and such. And there's two Kellogg's. There's John Harvey Kellogg. He's the golden child. He's the doctor who runs everything. Everyone loves him. His parents got him to medical the Seventh-day Adventist community locally pooled together to get sent to the medical school to run the sanitarium and be he massive ego on this man.
Okay.
Incredibly strange views on many different things, including very inappropriate things I don't really want to talk about on this podcast because of the time.
All right, so let's just say
circumcision.
Personally, he wasn't great, but professionally, he made cord flanks.
he had a brother named William Keefe, who was kind of like the dark horse of the family.
The black
sewing
sheep.
Machine salesman most of for his early childhood.
Oh, really?
But he had a much better business sense. He was not as like personable and, you know, egotistical and just, you know, up in everyone's face, but he was an excellent businessman. They always had a rough relationship, but they were close. They were brothers. They were working together. So they invent the machine. They invent a machine that is able to make cornflakes. It literally puffs the corn. It's like a cannon. If you ever look up MOFAD, Museum of Food and Drink in Brooklyn, they have one of these. And it literally uses pressure to just a little kettle that brings all the wheat, corn, whatever you have, to pressurize them and cook them until they're so hot. And then suddenly all the pressure booms out. And all the in the grain it puffs. The carbohydrates are gelatinized, so they're not, you know, hard and tough and mealy. They puff up. They are made into a crispy, crunchy, airy snack that absorbs milk. I cannot hear you.
That's because I moved my thing up to take a drink of water. It absorbs milk.
I see.
That's all I said. It wasn't that fascinating? Yes. I was just being supportive.
So you end up with this machine, and it's a prototype. It's not been patented yet. John Harvey Kellogg says, let's have this in the dining room, in the breakfast room. Everyone will see it. Everyone will love it. This is going to be so cool. And William Keefe's like, we don't have it patented yet. There's nothing stopping someone from observing it and just stealing our idea and running with it.
Right.
William Keefe Kellogg is overruled.
Uh-oh.
A man from Texas who has had a mental breakdown in the real estate industry comes up to recover to the sanitarium.
Sure.
He's a businessman. He sees the machine.
A really cool machine.
And takes notes and watches it and makes his own before it's patented. That man's name is Post.
It is Post.
Post sets up the factory literally across the river in Battle Creek, right next door. And for decades, these two factories are rivals, like literally dead set rivals.
Yeah, yeah.
Jerry Seinfeld, the Seinfeld movie about the Pop-Tarts recently,
Okay. That
was about that rivalry. That's a dramatization in making fun of that literal rivalry in Battle Creek.
Right, except
they
for
had different,
they yeah. took it very seriously. You can make fun of it.
Incredibly
but
so.
I bet you Mr. Kellogg was pretty mad. I read a book about Marjorie Post, who was his daughter. And she was the one who expanded the Post empire after his death. And she built Mar-a-Lago. Speaking of Captain Knobjob and his douche nozzles.
Fascinating.
And she should have taken it with her. Anyway, that's cornflakes.
That's cornflakes. So I know the university I'm on, it was built on William Keefe Kellogg's winter home estate in Southern California, where he had an Arabian horse ranch. He gave it to the state of California. It's now my university.
Oh, nice. Sliced bread.
1928.
Huh.
You've heard that Dolly Parton is older than sliced bread?
Yes.
She is.
She is actually. Was she born before 1928?
I believe 1926.
Okay.
She's 2 years older than sliced bread.
All right. Well.
Then you have Spam, as you know, 1937, the late 30s.
Okay.
Fed our allies in World War II.
Right.
UK and Soviet Union civilian soldiers basically just ate Spam because they couldn't.
Millions.
What else would they eat?
Right. Made his fortune on Spam. Yeah.
And lastly, as you correctly predicted, Cheese Whiz, 1952.
52!
It's an aerosolized, it's a spray cheese, it's aerosolized cheese product in a can with a, you know, spray, a whipped cream style top.
What is in it?
American cheese, I assume, and a lot of emulsifiers. And American cheese is literally just real cheese that has been added a bunch of emulsifiers, things like sodium salts into it. That just make it spread more easily and melt a lot more easily.
Okay. It's
people say American cheese is plastic.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of has a plasticity in that sheen. It's not really plastic. It is maybe low. It could be low grade cheese or low quality cheese, perhaps, but still dairy product. It's just okay. they add some sodium, some emulsifiers. I don't have any off the top of my head, but these are not like toxic things. This is just literally think of like calcium chloride, sodium chloride. This is not far off from salt. But it makes it melt much more easily. It makes it kind of stick together more as a contiguous, block rather than when heated. And it makes it easier to process with and make, a horrible aerosolized cheese product out of.
Right. It just launches it right onto a cracker in a star, beautiful star shape. We're almost at an hour.
Yep. I see.
Yep. And is there anything that you would like to close on?
Absolutely.
A happy food science. Let's hear it.
So I have a few books for recommended reading. And one of them is a cookbook. Do you know The Food Lab by Kenji Lopez Alt?
I've heard of it. Yes.
It is, I think, the greatest application of food science for the non-food scientist in your own kitchen.
Okay.
It is excellently written. It has amazing recipes, but it actually shows you through his own experiments where you just cooking an egg salted water, like just different variations, how food science in your own kitchen actually affects what you get when you're eating it.
Okay.
What Einstein told his cook. This is a book of various little short essays and stories about what we were talking about today, random questions and interesting quandaries about food science. Like, hey, can I freeze this? Or what is MSG, which I could talk about for a long time as well. And is it bad or good?
Right.
And ask you if you want to take a real deep dive on food and cooking by Harold McGee. It is this thick. It is a massive tome of incredible. I don't have it with me. It's at home. Incredibly. It's our cookbook, but it's everything you ever wanted to know about each kind of food and food ingredient.
What's it called?
It's On Food and Cooking. It is probably one of the best popular food science texts out there. It basically explains the science and cooking and a lot of just the general trivia and knowledge about pretty much every food and drink you can think about especially from like fruits, vegetables, meats, how these work at, scientifically and how people have used them culturally. Highly recommend all of those.
My sister gave me a book, I think she gave it to me. It was a bread book about math and baking.
Yes. Baking is so precise.
Right. And it's called Ratio. And the simple code behind here's what I haven't done.
I know.
Read it.
Yep.
Okay. And so what I have done is I've looked at it. There it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's got a bunch of circles. The Simple Codes Behind the Craft of Everyday Cooking by Michael Ruhlman and Ratio. Mm-hmm. And it's all about, proportion to create breads, as I think. But maybe there was more to it. I only saw the bread part. Okay. Mm-hmm. Get this. It's been an hour. And you could talk about MSG just for another hour. So
most likely.
Alexander Matthews, thank you so much for doing the Dork Forest. If you guys have other questions or just want to follow him on Instagram and hang out and, there might be more food science trivia. You don't know.
Mm-hmm.
It's at ZE_Matthews. If you're not in the US of A. Thanks a lot, Alexander. That was super fun.
You're very welcome. You're so welcome. This was a blast to do.
And Rangers, you know the rules out there. Take care of each other.
My hat, my hat, my hat. They're dancing around my hat. My hat, my hat, my hat. Well, what do you think of that? If it looks like a Mexican hat dance and it sounds like a Mexican hat dance, it's most likely a Mexican hat dance. So take off your hat and let's dance.
Yay! Oh, my God. Why don't we just call that as the end of the show?